Hey everybody, Christopher Stolle back for Breaking the Fourth Wall Entertainment. In case you guys haven't noticed yet, it has been a while since I've done a podcast. I got a few things I want to talk about before we get into the main meat of the show. The first and foremost thing I want to talk about is you may notice this is an audio-only podcast presented on Anchor or podcasting for Spotify. There is a reason for that. I am sick and tired of YouTube. I've put a lot of work and effort into videos and everything else just to have us buried in the algorithm because we don't fit the format style or don't have the audience of other people within the YouTube community. I have no problems with people in the YouTube community. They are awesome people, most of them, that I have interacted with in some way, shape, or form. I have enjoyed my time creating content for YouTube, but it's just so much effort and so much work. It really drained me out. Part of the reason why I took such a long hiatus on doing podcasts, because of the fact that it was a battle. It was a constant argument. They tried to strike me on YouTube for music that I wrote and created. I own the rights to, you know, as a musician. They tried to claim that somebody else owned the rights to my music, and I had to fight them on that because they tried to give me a copyright strike for it. So the plain and simple fact is that I'm done with the legal loopholes and the push of particular agendas on YouTube. So I am no longer going to be doing anything on YouTube as far as Breaking the Fourth Wall Entertainment is concerned. Does that mean I won't do Rumble? Well, maybe eventually, but more than likely, even if I do videos, it's probably going to release on here, and you guys can find us on Spotify, you can find us on Apple and iTunes, you can find us wherever you find audio podcasts, and that's going to be good enough. The second part is my partner in crime, Serenity Stone, is still dealing with some family issues and all that. I wish her well. I'm not rushing or forcing her to come back anytime soon, although she does desire to do so. She misses doing it. She misses hanging out with you guys. She misses having the conversations that we would have on the podcast. So look for her to return, but don't look for her to return just yet. With all that said, I do intend to return to at least a weekly podcast starting now. Now, the new format of Breaking the Fourth Wall Entertainment, the new format of Breaking the Fourth Wall Podcast is going to be returned to form in a sense, where Breaking the Fourth Wall is just simply going to talk about what it feels like talking about that particular week. We may collect a bunch of shit up through the week and talk about a whole bunch of things, or like this episode, we'll concentrate on one in particular subject matter and talk about it. And of course, no rules. We're breaking the fourth wall here. We're going to talk about things like politics. We're going to talk about things like entertainment. We're going to talk about things like music and movies and maybe just personal experiences. There may be a slow news day that we just sit down and talk about people we dated at one point and how weird some of their habits are. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is it's going to go back to a undefinable podcast because it, like the TV show Seinfeld, which I can't stand Seinfeld, but the concept of Seinfeld would be perfect for the return of Breaking the Fourth Wall, which is simply, it is a podcast about nothing and a podcast about everything. So guys, welcome back to Breaking the Fourth Wall. I'm so thankful you're here checking us out. I'm happy to be here to hang out with you guys. I am looking forward to this. And especially right now, I figured this is a perfect one to get into. I waited a while to do this podcast. One, because I didn't want to spoil anything. I wanted to make sure everybody had an ample amount of time because I wasn't really sure what the embargo on it was. But I wanted to make sure that everybody got a chance to see it, to be able to go through all of it before we sat down and talked about it, because there's going to be a bunch of spoiler talk in this from my standpoint, because I am a huge fan of the franchise. And so we've got to talk about it. We've got to talk about the Fallout TV show on Amazon Prime. Now, for those that are uninitiated, Fallout is a franchise in the video game industry that came out in 1997 from Interplay Interactive. They did the first two Fallout games as well as a couple spin-offs alongside with Black Isle Studios before the franchise was bought by Bethesda Softworks, who in turn changed it from a top-down, two-dimensional turn-based RPG into a first-person 3D action shooter RPG, which we got within Fallout 3, Fallout 4, and Fallout 76. And of course, I would be remiss, and I know a lot of people would shoot me, probably with a fat boy, if I turned around and did not mention, of course, the spin-off by Obsidian Entertainment known as Fallout New Vegas. So there have been a lot of different formats of the Fallout franchise from a lot of different studios who all work together to give a pretty cohesive story arc and lore to the world of Fallout. And one of the hardest things and one of the biggest things I was worried about with the TV show was keeping that lore intact. Because of the fact that there is so much lore. You're talking over 200 plus years of the post-apocalypse lore that has been put into the games, and of course the pre-war lore that they created to give you a backstory of how the world wound up as it is. And I'm not, again, I'm probably talking to fans of the franchise themselves, so I don't need to rehash it. Because of the fact that I know there's enough channels out there and enough content creators out there who have beaten it to death. And of course, us being fans, we know the lore like the back of our hands. From the downfall of the United States, the annex of Canada, to the Great War, to the vault opening and creating new factions and stories and different settlements throughout the what we know of the world thus far. So when Fallout was announced to be a TV show, the first thing that I breathed a sigh of relief on was the fact that they said that they were going to keep it connected to the video game universe. It was not going to be a rehash of anything that we've seen in the video games so far. However, it's going to stay true to the lore that the games have established through the 25 plus years that Fallout has been a franchise. In fact, they made sure to set this in a future past the last game, which in the chronicle timeline would be Fallout 4. And if I remember correctly, Fallout 4 takes place somewhere around like 2281, and this takes place in 22, I want to say 96. So it's at least a decade past Fallout 4. So everything that has happened in the games has happened. And of course, there was a controversy, which we will talk about as we go further into this episode. There was a controversy of a particular scene that a lot of people thought may counteract or retcon or contradict a story arc in Fallout New Vegas. And of course, Bethesda and the other director, Nolan. Can't remember. I want to say Christopher, but it's not Christopher. It's his brother, Jonathan Nolan, did come out and state that that was a misinterpretation because of the way the people looked at it, and actually, that what this scene represents is something that transpired after Fallout New Vegas. So, the Fallout New Vegas timeline is intact, is canon, and is intact. So that to me gave me a big sigh of relief because I get where people were misunderstanding of that scene, but I myself from the first time I saw it, I kind of got it. Like I didn't understand the 2277 storyline as far as the fall of, and I'm using air quotations, but I got that what transpired afterwards, even though it didn't get a year box on it. I still got it as what it was supposed to represent as this happens after 2277. 2277. And again, I'm trying to avoid spoilers because I want to go through the episodes as they were. Not because people haven't seen the episodes yet, but because I want to keep everything in the timeline. But I just wanted to address that because it is part of the statement that that we're saying here is that the showrunners did put attention to detail and show their love and respect to the video game franchise and the lore that it has created by trying to stay true in many, many ways to how the game has set up the story arcs for the past 219 plus years since the dropping of the bombs in the Great War. And I think that is absolutely wonderful. Now, the other thing I want to address, another controversy, another complaint that a lot of people have, that I've seen, I can't say a lot of people have, but I have seen online and other reviews and everything else that I've watched, is they feel that a lot of what happened in the first eight episodes, particularly to a particular faction, you know what, why am I tripping over my own words, talking about non-spoiling, the NCR, with in particular statements about the NCR being completely wiped out or destroyed. They're not. There's two things you got to take into consideration. First off, stop with the instant gratification. They did drop eight episodes at once, which allowed us to binge about 8 hours of this TV show, which is great, but at the same time, I think it kind of made people expect to have 100% answers by the end of the eighth episode of the whole entire story. And you got to remember, this is still an ongoing, continuous story. There's going to be a season two. The showrunners knew they wanted to write a season two. They did not give you all your eggs in one basket. Yes, they introduced the fact that the NCR has been decimated in California. They have introduced that New Vegas has been pretty fucked up as of this point, as to the last time we saw it. Does that mean the NCR is completely destroyed and gone and have, you know, Bethesda has no respect for what Obsidian and Interplay created with the NCR? No. No, it does not. It means it's a mystery that we have not gone through the full storyline of. We don't know how the NCR fell. We don't know how the NCR started to decline. And we don't know if the NCR is completely destroyed because of the fact that from the game lore, by the time we reach Fallout New Vegas, the NCR is spread thin. Very thin, because they were expanding way, way too much. And the reason they were expanding because they were one of the largest factions who were actually creating a solidified government within the wastelands of America, starting on the West Coast. But they were pushing east past the Colorado and river and everything else, and they were stretching themselves thin. So there is a lot of story arc that could go there politically. There's a lot of story arc that could go there financially, for lack of a better term. It could be they ran into the wrong people, like another faction of the Brotherhood of Steel, for example. Or maybe another cell of the Enclave that helped create the downfall of the NCR. We don't know. And that's the point. They did not destroy the NCR yet, and until they finish that story arc, you cannot say that they did destroy the NCR. Nor have they done the NCR dirty or done anything that would not pay homage to what came before as far as the NCR is concerned. And quite honestly, I would like to see them eventually destroy or not destroy, but maybe what's the term I'm looking for? Transform the NCR. I don't like the idea of the greatest government to come out of the nuclear apocalypse to be California. I'm sorry, California is garbage in this world. It was garbage in that world. Nobody from California would stand against anything that has been thrown in the Fallout franchise. Let's be honest and let's be real. But the concept of the NCR as a government and as a military and as a callback to the old world America, but not the elitist like the Enclave, I like that concept. So I'd like to see the NCR not necessarily be destroyed as a faction, but be rebranded into something that is more inclusive to the rest of the United States wasteland. I would like to see that type of story arc. But of course, again, that's all spitballing, that's throwing spaghetti at a wall to see what sticks. I don't know because I'm not one of the writers, and that's my point. You don't know because you're not one of the writers. We were given 6 episodes to establish the world in this new story arc of Fallout, and that's all we were given. We were given some answers I was not expecting. I really was not expecting. Addressing some things that I really was not expecting. But we were also given things that were purposely left open-ended because they want to hook you into season 2, season 3, season 4, however many seasons this series may go on to, which if they continue on the path that they created in season 1, should give them a solid 8 seasons, in my opinion. But to again, I'm jumping ahead of the gun, but I wanted to address these things before we started breaking down the story arc of what we have thus far. All right, so episode 1 begins with the dropping of the bombs, as well as showing Walton Goggins playing Cooper Howard, the cowboy movie star, which at this point, when we're introduced to him, he's divorced, he's down on his luck, he's playing birthday parties as his iconic movie character, and he's looked down upon by most of the people. And again, I don't need to go through the complete breakdowns of the episodes, talk about the things I like and dislike, get your guys' opinion in the comments and all that, but overall, this is probably one of the prettiest and disturbing intros I think I've ever seen in any television show. Even if I was not a fan of Fallout, the video games, to see this transpire as the intro, the opening, watching the bombs drop on Los Angeles was absolutely blood-chilling. It was beautifully shot. It was absolutely, it hooks you in, it grabs you, but it depresses the fuck out of you because of how realistic that looks. And of course, we're in a retro future atomic punk reality where time divergence split, where we don't have a world like we have now. In 2077, they have those retro future of what 1950s Americans thought the future would be, the world of tomorrow. They have that. But the mentality and the mindsets and a lot of the cultural references have remained 1950s, 1960s American exceptionalism. And so, even though we have that and it's obviously detached from our reality, to watch a city like Los Angeles get nuclear bombs dropped on it out of the blue, you know how close to reality that is right now with the state of the world? That makes it that much eerier. And I don't want to sound like one of these doomsay sayers. I'm not talking about everybody should be in a bomb shelter, World War III, blah blah blah, remnant of scare. But I'm saying with the way the state of the world right now and the wars we're in and the way the politicians are acting, just to watch this scene in that mindset and that aspect is absolutely scary. How real it could be. But of course, the bombs drop, and we cut to a black screen, and we get our first title card of Fallout, and then it kicks 219 years into the future. And we're introduced to the character Lucy, who is a vault dweller of Vault 33. She is an interesting character because she is designed to be a blank slate character, much like many of the characters many of us in the game who play the games would play. Because outside of games like Fallout 2 and Fallout New Vegas, you primarily start as a vault dweller. And when you start as a vault dweller, you come out of the vault and you're thrust into this wasteland and you don't know dick about this world. And that is exactly what Lucy is. She was raised in a sheltered vault where everybody's nice and friendly and happy, and she's not ready for the world above. Let's just put it that way. She's very, very helpful, very friendly, and very naive. Now, again, I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but when we get introduced to Vault 33, we get that Lucy is pretty much the same type of Denison as everybody in 33. We also find out that 33 is interconnected with Vault 32 and another Vault 31. And part of what they do is they will exchange dwellers with each other for the purposes of marriage and breeding. So that way they keep the gene pool diverse. They don't have it become stagnant because, you know, half cousins are starting to fuck each other and create three-toed babies, or whatever the case may be. So it makes sense, but this is the first time in the franchise we're introduced to a vault that is connected to other vaults. We've never seen that before in the franchise. Normally, vaults are independent shelters that have their own particular experiments or mysteries to them that do not connect to other vaults in any particular or meaningful way. So when we're introduced to Vault 33 and we find out that they exchange with 32 and they get overseers from 31, that's an interesting connection that we've never seen before. So either way, I'm jumping ahead on the purposes. I will get to that later, but I just wanted to point out that that was an interesting thing. So as we get past that, Lucy is now set up to marry a Denison of Vault 32. They set up in the common area of 33, a little wedding. And of course, Vault 32 Denisons come over and everybody is invited to the wedding. Lucy gets married to a guy named Monty and the celebration begins. As the celebration begins, you start realizing that the mannerisms of Vault, the Denisons of Vault 32, very different from the happy-go-lucky 33s. And later on, it's discovered the reason why is because they were not vault dwellers. They were raiders and remnants of the NCR under the leadership of a NCR person named Moldaver, who came to, for some reason, ransack 33, kill a lot of people, and kidnap the overseer, who happens to be Lucy's father, played by Kyle MacLachlan, who, for people who don't know, was the original Paul Atreides in the 1984 Dune, as well as made a name for himself in the Twin Peaks TV show. So, big high name, good actor. They kidnap him, they blow up the entrance to 32, from 33 to 32, and they are gone, and Lucy decides that she's going to go out and find her dad. So she has her mission now to leave the vault. She leaves out into the world of the wasteland of Los Angeles, which I believe is still being constituted as the Boneyard, although a lot of people on the surface refer to it as the Wild. So take your pick on whether or not it's still a Boneyard or whatever. But she goes out and she makes her way to a town called Philly. And on her way, she meets some of the surface dwellers, which I will get into later. I'm going to diverse off of that onto the next character, Maximus. Because after she leaves the vault, we are transferred over to a Brotherhood of Steel initiate slash recruit named Maximus, who is getting the shit kicked out of him because his brotherhood brothers and sisters, they don't really like him. They pick on him, they bully him, they beat him up, but the guy takes a beating and keeps on ticking. Come to find out that Maximus was a survivor of the bombing of Shady Sands and was rescued by the Brotherhood at a young age, and he latched onto them as anybody would, their heroes or their rescuers, even though he does not necessarily feel comfortable within their organization. And I will admit that the Brotherhood is a little confusing to me in the show. The Brotherhood has always been kind of a gray area as far as good versus evil, depending on the game you play and which faction of the Brotherhood that you find, because it is fractionalized between the East Coast, the West Coast, the Midwest, Brother Lions versus Elder Maxon controlled Brotherhood. They all had different mentalities, but in the overall arc of the Brotherhood of Steel, they have always been singularly focused on the finding and preservation, to the detriment of the wastelands, to be honest, of old world technology. And in this show, they still do that. They, you know, that as typical Brotherhood is, but they are a lot more religious zealot than they are usually portrayed in the video games. That could be this faction, that could be this elder leader influence, or maybe we're just being given more than the games have ever given us before as far as the backstory lore of the Brotherhood, because this Brotherhood still does answer to what they call the East Coast Brotherhood, which at this point is controlled under Elder Maxim, who is a Brotherhood purist. He believes in the old school, you know, we don't really care about the denizens of the world as much as we must collect everything pre-war tech and hoard it, not allow the morons of the wasteland to do to humanity what it's already done before with creating the Great War. That is the simplified version, but the idealistic version of what the Brotherhood of Steel is. Well, neither here nor there, getting back to the story arc at hand, the Brotherhood decide to, through different means, and again, you've watched the show, I don't have to go beat for beat on everything, but we get introduced to Maximus. Maximus gets put in the position of becoming the squire to Knight Titus, and sent off into the wild to find a remnant of the Enclave. Which, for people who don't know, which I don't know why you're listening to this podcast if you don't know, the Enclave is the elitist arm of the United States government, who believe that the government and the world after the war bombs dropped should be given back to them, which are the one percenters. They're the rich people and everything else. And of course, they're xenophobic purists who believe that all denizens of the wasteland who may be human but irradiated, or the mutations that have happened from the bombs and everything else, should be completely wiped clean from the face of the earth, so that only naturally pure humans will re-inherit the earth under the rule of the rich and the powerful. That's the Enclave. Well, this guy is a scientist of the Enclave. He ran away with a experimental dog and a experiment that everybody in the wasteland, every faction in the wasteland wants. And again, I'm not going to sugarcoat everything because we already know this. It is a chip or experiment that creates cold fusion, which is enough power to power the entire wasteland for free. One of the major problems in the wasteland is that resources are very scarce. Power, water, things like that, it's all very scarce in this state, in this world. So Maximus is sent out with Knight Titus to go find this guy, bring him back with his experiment. And on their way, they run into a Yaogwai, which is an irradiated bear, grown to about 3-4 times the size of a grizzly bear. Very aggressive. Kicks the shit out of Titus and essentially leaves him to bleed to death. Titus turns out to be a punk, a coward, dies like a punk and a coward. Maximus decides to take over his power armor and his name and try to continue the quest, knowing full well that if the Brotherhood found out, they would kill him, but he figured they would forgive him if he comes back with the target. During this time, Lucy out in the wasteland winds up running into the target. And the guy actually turns out to be a semi-decent guy who tries to help Lucy out by telling her to go home. She's not ready for the wasteland. But she runs into him yet again, and the dog yet again, in Philly, which is a settlement junk town in the middle of Los Angeles. I don't know why they call it Philly. I don't know why they set it up. But it is a cool town. Plenty of funny shit happens. This is also where we run into the story arc of the ghoul. Now, as I stated in the beginning of the podcast, Cooper Howard was a cowboy who got caught in the blast, and the blast irradiated him and turned him into what is known as a ghoul within the Fallout universe. And it's cool. It's great. You know, it's awesome. We already know that he was buried and they dug him up. They were giving him drugs to keep him alive and keeping him from going feral, which, again, that's another mystery that's going to be solved later on down the line, I hope, about drugs to keep ghouls from going feral and what type of drugs they are, because that is something added new to the Fallout franchise. At least it's never been discussed in the Fallout franchise. We always knew that there were ghouls and there was always a chance that ghouls could go feral, lose their minds. And it's never been addressed beyond that. So I'm interested in that story arc. But either way, he went from movie star to a ghoul who is probably one of the baddest bounty hunters in the wasteland. This guy is a crack shot, uses all his real cowboy skills very well. And we wind up in a shootout because I'm jumping ahead of myself. He did get a bounty to go and get this guy and bring him to Muldaver. So, again, we have the NCR Muldaver hiring bounty hunters to get this Enclave guy for the Cold Fusion Corps to be able to take it back to the NCR, as opposed to the other denizens like the Brotherhood of Steel, who are looking to get this thing for themselves and probably would treat it differently than the NCR does. Winds up in a big shootout. The guy, the Enclave official winds up getting his leg blown off in very brutal fashion. Maximus shows up to stop the ghoul from shooting Lucy. They wind up in a fight, and while they're in a fight, Lucy sneaks off with the target. Getting only so far down the road before the target takes a cyanide pill, besides bleeding out from his leg, dies, tells Lucy to cut off his head, which is injected with the Cold Fusion microchip, cut off his head and bring it to Muldaver herself, which will help her get her father back and also ensure that the power goes into what he has will go into the right hands, the hands he intends him to go. Disgusted as she is, she does it. And is walking on down the wasteland. Maximus and the ghoul finish their fight with Maximus being sent off because he doesn't really know how to use his power armor. Sent off crash landing somewhere, has to fix it. And the ghoul takes the target's dog and uses him to help track its original owner to be able to get caught up to the target. Now, I'm not going to do the rest of the breakdowns. I wanted to break down bringing in our three main characters, but the long story short of it is, after this, we wind up with a bunch of different interactions between the ghoul and Lucy, where we find out the ghoul is a very cruel guy, but we have backflashes of when he was Cooper Howard, when he was a movie star, how he was connected with Vault-Tec Industries. In fact, he's responsible for the iconic Vault Boy with the thumbs up. And he actually, inadvertently, at least through marriage, is pretty responsible to everything that came to be in the Fallout universe. I'll explain at the end. But we have those flashbacks of him learning about the way the world is in this timeline before the bombs drop, and how Vault-Tec got so powerful. And it is creepy. It is creepy. It is wonderful. He is an engaging character. I like Lucy as the fresh-faced. She is our exposition dump. She is perfectly naive enough for us, the viewers, to get the explanations of things that are going on within the show and things that we're introduced to that are not normal in everyday regular life. So somebody has to explain to us, oh, these are fiends, they're cannibals. Oh, this is a gulper. That's, you know, it was a salamander and a human that was mutated together thanks to radiation, and that's why it's got fingers for teeth. And she is our exposition dump, and her charming demeanor and bubbly personality fits perfectly with her naivety to allow us to live this world through her eyes. And I think Maximus, don't get me wrong, I like Maximus. I do like him as a character, but he's an idiot. He really is a good representation of what the surface world and Fallout is, because he wants to do good, I think. I think deep down he's a good person. He wants to do good, but he's not that bright. And he himself is very naive and uneducated in the way the world works, mostly because of living his own sheltered life within the confines of the Brotherhood of Steel. I think they play off of each other very, very, very well. And especially with moving along the story arcs as we discover things like when they go to Vault 4 and they discover the fate of Shady Sands and NTR, and that's where that quote-unquote hiccup in the timeline was when Lucy learned about the downfall of Shady Sands and the dropping of the bomb that destroyed the town, which was also at one point the capital of the NCR. It's important for people who never played the game to know that. So, as we continue on, we finally get to the observatory, which is where Moldaver was hiding out. Lucy gets there to give the head to Moldaver, and Moldaver, to get Moldaver to release her father, and that be the end of it. We wind up finding out that not only is Moldaver from pre-war, and again, kind of open-ended on how she wound up 219 years later being one of the leaders of at least a offshoot of the NCR, but she knows Lucy's father, who was an assistant at Vault-Tec Industries before the pre-war. We also come to discover that the ghoul's wife, can't remember her name off the top of my head, but Mrs. Howard was a high-ranking official in Vault-Tec, and through a little bit of espionage, we discover that Vault-Tec, along with other major industries, had designed the vault systems specifically to eliminate anybody that was not worthy to be a part of the new world after the bombs dropped, headed by management teams of Vault-Tec Industries. And to ensure financially that the investment in the vaults and their plans would succeed, they were willing and probably more than likely, I can't say it's 100% confirmed, because we have contradicting story arcs where it was believed China was the first one to drop the bomb. And of course there's story arcs of Mr. House in New Vegas, who was able to protect New Vegas because of the fact that he knew when the bombs were dropping. However, with the way the story began in this TV show and Cooper Howard at that birthday party and all that, it kind of leaves the impression that Vault-Tec did not drop the bombs. That's for debate of another day. But the fact of the matter is that they were at least willing to drop the bomb to start the war themselves, simply to financially be able to make profit not only from the vaults, but start their experimentations and setting up to create a perfect society by wiping the slate clean and creating a new civilization under their management rule, which was the reason for the tri-vaults in 31, 32, and 33. 32 and 33 were created to be breeding stock for the cryogenically frozen management and junior management teams of Vault Tech. That's what was going on. And this, of course, is discovered by Lucy's brother, Norm, who I didn't talk about in this episode. I'll talk about him in future episodes, maybe, if I go deeper into the Fallout lore from this show. But overall, we discovered that Lucy's father's from the pre-war was part of the whole Vault-Tec scheme. Moldaber's from the pre-war. She's trying to stop the whole Vault-Tec scheme, plus give free power to everybody within the wastelands. Cooper, his main reason for being 219 years wandering the wastelands was not just because he was a ghoul and not just because he likes to be a bounty hunter. He has been searching for his wife and daughter because of the bombs dropping and his wife being a high-level executive for Vault-Tec. He truly believes that she should still be alive in one of these special good vaults for the Vault-Tec representatives. So he is looking for her. All the while, Maximus is, by sheer dumb luck, rising through the ranks of the Brotherhood of Steel, even though his whole entire wish is to leave the Brotherhood, go back to Vault 33 with Lucy, and make his cock explode. For people who saw the TV show, that will make sense. and eat some caviar and oysters. But, overall, when we end the episode, we have Lucy and the ghoul teaming up to go chase after her father, who escaped in power armor from the battle at the observatory. The NCR is left decimated, Moldaber is dead, and Maximus is getting his praises sung as the killer of Moldaber, even though he was unconscious the whole entire time and had nothing to do with it. And then last but not least, we have the Overseer, Lucy's dad, walking through the deserts coming up to the remnants of New Vegas, which should make everybody in the Fallout, which should make everybody in the Fallout universe extremely thrilled to see that we are going to be entering Season 2 in New Vegas, which again states beyond a shadow of a doubt that New Vegas is canon within this timeline and within this franchise, still with this TV show interconnecting with the video game franchises. Now, with that breakdown, let's go ahead and talk about my thoughts on this show. I went in cautious. Optimistically cautious. Of course I'm going to watch a Fallout TV show. I love Fallout as a franchise. I love Fallout as a video game series. It's my favorite video game series next to Final Fantasy. I absolutely love the original Interplay and Black Isle Studio ones all the way up to everything Bethesda has done. Even 76. And if you paid attention to my previous podcast where I talk Fallout, I am one of the people who have defended 76 for a very long time before it actually finally got good, where other people started seeing what I saw and the potential I saw way back years ago. Not saying I'm a prophet or anything, just saying that I have been a fan of the Fallout franchise forever. So I was pretty confident, or at least cautiously optimistic, that I would like the TV show. But did I expect it to be as good, as funny, as dark, and as engaging as it wound up becoming? Did I expect it to be as catching to it that not only fans of the franchise, but people who just enjoy good TV shows would get on board? Did I expect this show to be so good that within a couple of weeks, it more than triples Bethesda and Fallout's numbers on Steam and probably on consoles with all the different Fallout games, including 76 and Fallout 4, having spikes in players and downloads and everything. I mean, huge spikes in it. Did I expect that from this show? No. No, I wouldn't even in a million years expect it. I expected a fringe group of people who are fans of the video game series to enjoy the show. That's what I expected. This has been more than I could have imagined. It's been more than I think even Todd Howard and Bethesda could have imagined. I almost suspect that it was more than even Amazon would have expected. First off, we know that video game adaptations are usually not the greatest set for TVs or movie. There's very few that are successful. Some are cult classics, even though they're arguably bad. There are most that are arguably bad. But as of late, we have seen some decent turnouts. Of course, I'm looking at The Last of Us, although I never watched the show because I never cared about the game franchise. It never caught my interest. Or the Super Mario Brothers movie, which a lot of people predicted doom because of, some of the voice actors and all that, but turned out to be a very cute and enjoyable, computer animated movie. But Fallout may actually be the greatest video game adaptation to television or film ever. And I'm not just saying that as a fan of the franchise, but they did everything right. Like I said, it's engaging. It sticks to the lore. It explains things for people without being condescending. It has irrelevant humor and a style and at some points tasteful slapstick which are faithful to the games and the dialogue systems and everything else. Even how characters respond to things feel like some of the dialogue systems in the game, where you're actually choosing the best answer you can come up with. And then there's the dark shit, the stuff behind the vaults and who really started the war and what are some of the secret motivations of these factions that you think are good guys or not good guys. They absolutely created a perfect, close to, I don't want to use the word perfect. Perfect's not a good word. Because, of course, there is flaws. Everything has flaws. Nothing is ever perfect. Could there be something better than Fallout in the future? Sure, absolutely. Have they reached it yet? No. Not in my opinion. But I think if I were to give it an arbitrary number, I would give it a 9.5 out of 10. It is that close. And in my mind, I cannot wait. I'm glad they greenlit Season 2, although I don't think there was ever a question that they would. Although I am thrilled they're greenlighting it, I just hope that two things happen within the future. And I'm not going to speculate in this video on storyline-wise what I want to have happen in Season 2. But I will say what I do want to have happen in Season 2. And that is, one, I don't want it to take forever. I hope they already are working on it, since they did dump the full first season on us in one binge collection instead of stretching it out for 8 weeks episodically. It means, we get to watch it over and over again. We got to binge it the first time and go through the whole entire story like it's a movie. But now we got to wait for Season 2. And that wait feels longer because we've already had the first 8 episodes so quickly. So I hope they're fast with Season 2. Already in the works for it. My hope, anyway. But the second thing I hope, besides that they don't take too long, is that, okay, I get dumping Season 1. I get the idea of dumping Season 1. Excuse me, I'm washing something out. I get the idea of dumping Season 1 because of people not knowing how the franchise is going to go, not knowing how the series goes, obviously expecting people to take a look at this through the eyes of people who have never played the game before, Amazon Prime subscribers who maybe watch TV but don't necessarily play video games or the like. So designed for them, dump the first season, so that way everybody can really binge in, get caught up into the world, the story arc and everything else. That makes sense to me. That does make sense to me. But season two, we've had that excitement, we had that ability. I want weekly cliffhangers. Give me an episode a week. Now, again, if you're doing 8, 10, 12 episodes, that's fine. One episode a week. And make me think and discuss and talk and overanalyze each episode as we move forward. I think that would be great for the fans. I think that would be great for stretching out the story arc. I think that would be great to keep the interest in the franchise past the first season. That's my thought process. I'm wondering what you guys think. Leave me some comments here on the episode. Tell me what you think. What did you think of the franchise? Where do you think the franchise will go in season two? As far as story, we already know location, but as far as story is concerned, and let me know what you think. Which format would be best? Should we do another binge dump for season two? Should it be episodic and weekly? And last but certainly not least, how long do you think we have to wait for season two to happen? Let me know in the comments down below. And again, thank you very much for hanging out with me. I hope you enjoyed it. Welcome back to Breaking the Fourth Wall. I will see you next week. Until then, be good to each other.